case, Central States versus U.S. Foods, Mr. Kashari.
May it please the court. My name is Mark Kashari, and along with Christopher Busey, we represent U.S. Foods in this appeal. This appeal presents an important issue of first impression on the arbitrability of Title IV of disputes in ERISA. And Title IV is the section or the part of ERISA that deals with withdrawal liability, with which this court is quite familiar. The standard of review is de novo for this court. So this court is operating on a clean slate. Yes, Your Honor.
The first question is whether we have appellate jurisdiction. Now, Section 16A1B, which you're relying on, says that an interlocutory appeal is possible about a denial of a request for arbitration under Section 4 of the Federal Arbitration Act. This is a request for arbitration under ERISA, the Multi-Employer Pension Plan Amendments Act to ERISA. So how does it come within the scope of Section 16?
Well, Your Honor, in 29 U.S.C. Section 1401 of ERISA, the Federal Arbitration Act is specifically referenced and incorporated. So what we have here is a dispute over the conducting of an arbitration.
Look, Section 16 is quite precise. It says under Section 4, particularly, of the Federal Arbitration Act. Section 4 refers to a party aggrieved, and I quote, by the alleged failure, neglect, or refusal of another to arbitrate under a written agreement for arbitration, close quote. So to come within Section 16, you must come within Section 4. If there's something about the MPPAA that put you within Section 4, then the argument is perfectly straightforward. But where is the written agreement for arbitration?
Your Honor, there is no written agreement for arbitration. There is a statutory provision that incorporates the Federal Arbitration Act, including Section 4 and Section 16. And I repeat, in 29 U.S.C. Section...
I don't see how that gets you what's necessary, which is the written agreement.
Well, it's a question of incorporation.
Let me ask the question another way. Has any other court of appeals held that the denial of a motion to arbitrate under the MPPAA is immediately appealable under Section 16?
Your Honor, not to my knowledge. This is a case of first impression, as I said. The point, though, is, and this Court has held before, that the Federal Arbitration Act is incorporated by the ERISA section I mentioned. The point is that ERISA says any in Section 1401B3, any arbitration proceeding under this section shall be conducted in the same manner, subject to the same limitations, carried out with the same powers.
That sounds like an adoption of the procedures for how arbitration proceeds, how arbitration occurs. It doesn't sound like, and with respect to Section 16A1B, please ignore the actual language of Section 4.
Well, what we have here, though, is a question about procedure. We have an ongoing arbitration that the parties have agreed is properly before an arbitrator. We have an issue about how that is to be conducted.
Counsel, trying to talk over a judge doesn't help. We have a question about appellate jurisdiction. There's nothing about appellate jurisdiction in the MPPAA.
I would disagree, Your Honor. I think the section I quoted does also confer jurisdiction on this court. The consequences, if that is not the case, are dramatic. That means that this issue that is now presented to the arbitrator and that the federal district judge said cannot be presented to an arbitrator would be unreviewable. There would simply be no...
No, it would not be reviewable on an interlocutory appeal. It would be reviewable from a final decision, like any other issue in the case. That is, of course, how arbitration decisions were reviewed before Section 16 was enacted in the late 1980s.
Well, what is different in this case, though, is you would never get a final decision from a district court on the question that we present here today.
Why not? Because
the district court has ordered the arbitrator not to consider it. How could I possibly then get federal court review?
When the case is over, there can be an appeal on that issue. The case isn't over.
No, Your Honor, that's not true. When the case is over, if this case stands as it's now presented, the arbitrator...
I don't think you want to be taking this position, because now you're saying, you are confessing that if we dismiss this appeal for lack of jurisdiction, your goose is cooked and you can never present the issue on appeal. Well, you don't want to take that position, do you?
Well, it depends how this court writes the opinion on appeal, Your Honor. But as it stands now, the district court below has prevented the arbitrator from deciding the issue that we present here. And if that's the case, then this court's review of that arbitration decision can only be a review of what the arbitrator decided, not what he didn't.
I just don't get it. Yeah. The district judge will presumably assess withdrawal liability on his own, independent of the arbitrator, and whoever's dissatisfied by that decision can appeal.
Your Honor, in a earlier decision of this court, Bradford Scott Data Corporation versus Physician Computer Network, this court noted the problem of going back and forth between arbitration and the federal courts. And it said that the benefits of arbitration are eroded and may be lost and even turned into net losses if it is necessary to proceed in both judicial and arbitral forums or to do this sequentially. The worst possible outcome would be to litigate the dispute, to have the Court of Appeals reverse and order the dispute arbitrated, to arbitrate the dispute, and finally to return the court to have the award enforced. And that would be the consequences, Your Honor, of your reading of the Federal Arbitration Act in this case. And I think it would be inconsistent with this court's decision of Bradford Scott versus Physician Computer Network, which is 128 Federal 3rd 504.
Mr. Kasheri, if we have jurisdiction, you suggested one point in your brief that the issue of timeliness should be left to the arbitrator.
Yes, Your Honor.
And could you address our decision in the Chipman Trucking case where we seem to hold to the contrary?
Well, that case, if I remember correctly, involved simply a single assessment that was not timely arbitrated. That's not what we
have.
That
left the issue of timeliness for the courts.
Right, but that's not what we have under the facts of this case. What we have in this case is an arbitration that is timely. And the question is, what is the scope of that timely arbitration? So that the case that you referred to is different factually. What happened here is that U.S. Foods shut down one of its facilities in 2008. And the Central States Pension Fund...
Talking about the Egan facility?
Yes, I am. Mm-hmm. And what the Central States Pension Fund has said in issuing an assessment for $16 million is that we think the cessation of the obligation to contribute related to that shutdown actually occurred in 2009. U.S. Foods filed a timely demand for arbitration saying, no, the closure of that facility in 2008 meant that the partial withdrawal trigger also occurred in 2008. And the consequence of making that argument is to place before the arbitrator the question of remedy if U.S. Foods is correct. What is then the remedy? And that's where the first assessment, which has been referred to as Assessment 1, comes in.
Okay. As I understand, I'm trying to understand from the formula how you benefit from moving the Egan closure from 2009 to 2008.
Well, if the Egan closure is moved to 2008, then what we have is two partial assessments in one calendar year. We have the Fairfield...
Just by result of the arbitration, the later arbitration decision?
By the result of the arbitrator finding that Egan's closure really is in 2008. That's the hypothetical.
That's what you're aiming for.
Exactly. And in the context of this, we don't know how the merits are going to come out in this case, but that's what we have to presume.
You're putting an awful lot of energy into this. How much money is at stake here?
Well, the first assessment is $40 million.
How much is disputed?
Well, $16 million plus...
That's the second one.
Yes.
But why does it matter at this point whether the $16 million is assessed for 08 or 09?
Because if it's assessed in 08, then the $40 million is at issue.
I don't understand that.
Well, in order... The statute provides that there's only one partial assessment per year. So if the Egan assessment is placed in 08, the partial withdrawal liability fraction will require the arbitrator to decide whether or not the runoff payments to Central State in 09 belong in the numerator of that fraction when making one assessment for 2008, which is what the statute requires. And if they are taken out of the numerator, right now assessment one has those 2009 contributions in the numerator. If they're taken out, we have a different assessment.
Well,
than the 40 million.
As I understand the formula, if it turns out there was a bigger reduction in workforce in 08, then 40 million would be insufficient, right?
No, I don't understand
because
it that
way. Your numerator, let's see, how did we go here? The numerator, in essence, would be you'd have a greater reduction in the workforce. You'd have a greater proportion of the hypothetical complete withdrawal that you'd be responsible for in 2008.
No, because understand that in the Egan closure context, the reduction in the workforce all happened in 2008. Everyone agrees with that. There's no reduction in 2009 going on.
Well, the question is where that reduction is, which year is that attributed to, right?
Which year has the trigger, yes.
Yeah. But I don't understand, I mean, the way the formula works, whether it's 2008 or 2009, you still have to pay the partial withdrawal for those people, right?
Right, but it's a question of what's the right number.
So tell us, I mean, look, you're fighting about this. How much is actually in dispute here? If you get your hypothetical victory in this arbitration that may or may not occur, how much would you save?
If the Egan assessment...
How much would you ask the arbitrator to save you?
Well, the $16 million associated with the Egan assessment and approximately half of the $40 million associated with assessment one.
So you'd say both?
Yes.
Because the Egan cutback would not be applied to either year?
Because the Egan cutback would mean that the numerator of the partial withdrawal liability fraction would be less... And we would also be working off of an earlier unfunded death
benefit. If I got this straight, in essence, what you're trying to get here is a result in which there is no partial withdrawal for the Egan cutback?
No. There is a partial withdrawal for the Egan cutback, but it has to be considered in the same year as the earlier partial withdrawal with the Fairfield cutback.
So what?
It's the way the statute works. Your Honor, the point of this appeal is not who's right or wrong. And I fully concede that when the question is presented to the arbitrator, I don't know how the arbitrator is going to rule. I don't know how this court would rule if there's an appeal from the arbitrator's decision. I simply don't know. What I do know is that the issue that we've presented is an issue that has to be placed before the arbitrator in the first instance. That's how the statute works.
So you're back to the issue that timeliness must be decided by the arbitrator rather than by the court.
Yes, in the context. In the context of the facts of this case, it's not the only issue that's being decided. It's a remedy issue that implicates a timeliness decision, and that's what distinguishes this case from the one that you cited and one Central State cited. The issue is if what is the remedy if the arbitrator finds in favor of U.S. Foods on the Egan assessment? What happens to that first assessment? Does it require a recalculation because the fraction is different? That's the question. That's why this case is not merely a timeliness question.
Why are you trying to initiate a separate arbitration proceeding
with
a second notice?
I am not. There were two assessments by Central States. There was one demand for arbitration. And that demand is timely. It's timely. The parties agree with that, Your Honor. The question is, what is the scope of that arbitration? And the reason why this appeal is important is...
Actually, counsel, if you put the question that way, the jurisdictional issue gets even worse. Because Section 16 does not allow an appeal from an order affecting the scope of an arbitration that exists and is ongoing. It allows an appeal from an order denying arbitration. So as soon as you say this is only about the scope of an ongoing arbitration, we have a separate jurisdictional problem. And actually, we have Seventh Circuit authority on that question, whether a decision affecting the scope of an ongoing arbitration is within Section 16. We've held it is not.
Well, Your Honor, that I would argue that what is at issue here is the scope of an arbitration, but also the question of whether the issue is arbitrable at all. It's not. I'd have to take a look at the cases you're referring to, but what I think is unique about this case is that if this court does not allow the federal court to review the district court's decision denying arbitration here, there is no review of the issue that we presented to the arbitrator and that the court stopped from being considered by the arbitrator. There will be many more of these withdrawal liability disputes, Your Honor, and this question of the federal courts interfering with an ongoing arbitration is sure to arise again.
I'm puzzled by an argument you make. It's about the deadline for your filing your challenge to assessment one, I guess it was. It's on page 13 of your brief. You're talking about ERISA provides an employer no later than 90 days after receiving the assessment may ask the plan sponsor to review. You say, likewise, ERISA, another section, provides that the party may initiate the arbitration proceeding within a 60-day period. And then you say, which really startled me, the use of the permissive may suggests that a decision maker could find that strict compliance is not necessary. I don't get that. I mean, suppose I say to you, may I go home at 3 o'clock today? And you say yes. So I leave at noon on the ground that, well, the may is just permissive. That'd be ridiculous, right? When you say you may file a suit within 90 days, that's the deadline.
There's a difference between may and shall.
No. Look at my example. You may go home at 3. So you say, well, good. I don't have to come into work at all. Or I may go home at noon, right? That's nonsense.
Your Honor, I don't think it's... I think that's for the arbitrator to decide how may is...
No, you're wrong. There's no possible argument with that. You may file within 90 days. Doesn't mean, because it's may, you may file within 3 years, right?
Your Honor, I'll concede...
That can't be right.
Your Honor, I'll concede the point, but my point remains... I'll concede your point. What we have is a federal court defining the scope of an ERISA-mandated arbitration that is timely commenced. And that's why this case is important, and the court should not have done that. And that's why it should be reversed. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Khashoggi. Mr. Berliner?
May it please the Court, my name is Brad Berliner. I represent the Central States Pension Fund and Trustee Arthur Bunty in this matter. U.S. Foods would like this Court to believe that this case is about both the 2008 and 2009 withdrawal liability assessments. In reality, this case is solely about the 2008 withdrawal liability assessment and U.S. Foods' failure to timely initiate that arbitration. And to make that point clear, if you take a look at the facts, if Central States had not issued a 2009 withdrawal liability assessment, then there would be no dispute that the time period within which to seek arbitration had expired. At the same time, if in the currently ongoing arbitration concerning the 2009 withdrawal liability assessment, if the arbitrator rules in U.S. Foods' favor, then U.S. Foods is exactly where they would be had Central States never even issued a 2009 assessment. And what I mean by that is that if the 2009 assessment would simply disappear, as U.S. Foods concedes in its brief in this case, there can be only one partial withdrawal liability assessment in a year. There already is a 2008 withdrawal liability assessment. So if the 2009 withdrawal never happened, if the contributions were wrong, then there's a 2008 withdrawal liability assessment that was issued and that stands. And as Judge Hamilton pointed out correctly, The issue here is the contributions in the prorate year, the prorate year being the contributions in the year following the year of the withdrawal. In this case, that would mean, with respect to the 2008, the contributions in 2009. And correctly, where the way the formula works is if you increase the contributions in the prorate year,
What's the prorate year?
I'm sorry. The prorate year is the year following the date of the partial withdrawal. And so what you're trying to find out in a set, partial withdrawal liability is a fraction of complete withdrawal liability. And what you're trying to find out is the percentage, the degree to which the employer should be assessed partial withdrawal liability based upon how much of their contributions they're continuing to remit. The higher the contributions in the year following the withdrawal, the lower the withdrawal liability. But if U.S. Foods succeeded and proved that the contributions should not have been in 2009, they win the arbitration, there's no 2009 withdrawal liability. But the 2008 assessment stands on its own, and this court has held that the time limits for challenging withdrawal liability.
If that's right, Mr. Berliner, it sounds like your clients are exposed to a $16 million loss. And that surely would not be a position you'd want to advocate in the arbitration. Believe me, I'm hesitant about diving into the details of this, but the accounting issue as between 2008 and 2009, I would hope would not have too dramatic a financial effect. For example, suppose they win and they say, and the arbitrator says, you're right, Egan, the Egan withdrawal occurred in 2008. Shouldn't that mean the 2008 assessment goes up substantially?
It would
as a remedy for that correction? It's like the IRS telling you, no, you should have taken this deduction in 2008 instead of 2009.
In fact, if U.S. Foods could still challenge the 2008 withdrawal liability, what you would find is if you remove the contributions from 2009 and you move them to 2008, that would have, in retrospect, increased U.S. Foods' 2008 withdrawal liability.
Shouldn't that be an appropriate part of a remedy if they prevail in the arbitration? Of 2009, the timely arbitration?
Well, ultimately that would mean they have 2000. We don't believe that could be part of a remedy in the arbitration because the arbitration only concerns the 2009 assessment. But
wait a second. That sounds like you're saying if we made a mistake, there's no remedy for it, and that we've lost the ability to adjust 2008.
If
an arbitrator says that the 2009 assessment is out because the Egan withdrawal actually occurred in 2008, don't you want to raise the 2008 assessment to compensate for that?
Your Honor, Central States would have the right. As this court stated in DISA Industries, National Shopman Fund versus DISA Industries, a pension fund has the right to amend the withdrawal liability assessment. And Central States may, within a reasonable time, in fact, amend the withdrawal liability assessment. However, if Central States were to amend the withdrawal liability assessment, that would actually reopen the time period for an employer to seek to dispute that assessment.
But so why are we having this big fight?
That's a good question, Your Honor. We don't believe that this battle should be in front of this court for multiple reasons. One, because U.S. Foods did not timely challenge the 2008 assessment. And two, that any time an employer affects a withdrawal, the statute also provides with respect to subsequent withdrawals that there's a credit, and the credit is based upon a prior assessment. So it's impossible. Simply because a 2009 withdrawal is eliminated doesn't mean that all future withdrawal liability will be increased or decreased. But U.S. Foods' payment of partial withdrawal liability with respect to the 2008 or be it 2009 assessments would then serve as a credit to the extent they affect the future partial withdrawal or complete withdrawal. In any event, the U.S. Foods' reference to there being $20 million at stake with respect to the 2008, had they not had the time not expired to challenge that assessment, I don't know where that number has come from. I haven't seen that number. It hasn't been presented in the briefs. But simply moving a minimal amount of CBUs for a skeleton crew would not result in that kind of challenge. What U.S. Foods is looking at is trying to throw a whole host of additional issues into a challenge that they didn't timely initiate. To be clear, the statute clearly envisioned, Congress clearly envisioned when enacting the statute, that there would be situations in which there are multiple withdrawal liability assessments, be it a partial withdrawal and a complete withdrawal, or multiple partial withdrawals, or multiple partial withdrawals followed by a complete withdrawal. But sections 29 U.S.C., sections 1399 and 1401 deal with each withdrawal as its own entity, sets a time frame for requesting review and initiating arbitration as if each assessment is on its own. And the way Congress chose to deal with multiple withdrawals is to say that if you have multiple withdrawals, then there will be a credit towards a subsequent withdrawal based upon the employer's prior withdrawal. There's also an issue where assessments can be related to the extent that when we measure withdrawal liability, we measure 10 years of an employer's contributions. So if you're talking about a 2009 withdrawal, you're talking about the employer's contributions in the years 1999 to 2008. And to the extent the employer has a subsequent withdrawal in the next several years, it could be that you're looking at the overlapping, if not largely the same, contributions. But simply because an employer timely challenged a second assessment does not mean that the employer somehow gets the right to reopen the first assessment. Now, U.S. Foods relies upon the Sixth Circuit's decision in Null Beverages to suggest that, well, these 2009 and 2008 assessments are inextricably intertwined. But again, U.S. Foods has not displayed that that's the case. It's not the case. If the 2009 assessment disappears based upon the arbitrator's ruling, that simply means that the 2008 assessment stands where it is, the same as if Central States had never even issued the 2009 assessment. And if U.S. Foods truly believed that the issues were inextricably intertwined, then they would have moved to stay the arbitration with respect to the 2009 assessment. They have not. So this is really a matter where it is not uncommon that multiple withdrawals are related to some degree, to the extent they have overlapping contribution history, to the extent they provide for credit in the event of a subsequent withdrawal. But that doesn't give the right to reopen a prior assessment. I'd like to touch on this issue of the requirement that an employer request review and demand arbitration. And as this court held in Slocky, the short deadline provided in the statute reflects Congress's desire to have these disputes resolved expeditiously. And this court has repeatedly held, including, I believe for the first time in Shipman, that the...
Are you talking about the 90 days?
90 days to request review, right, and then roughly and approximately an additional 180 days to initiate arbitration, depending upon whether or not the pension fund responds to the request for review. As this court noted in Shipman, it is for the court to decide whether arbitration was timely initiated, and that's in order to retain its bite for the statute to retain its bite. Initially, U.S. Foods did not raise this issue of may versus shall in the district court. In their reply brief,
forget that.
I'm sorry?
You can forget the may shall business.
Okay. With respect to the assessment at issue, however, the key here is that these are two separately issued withdrawal liability assessments. They're distinct. They would offer distinct remedies. U.S. Foods has timely challenged the 2009 withdrawal liability assessment. That assessment is at issue in an ongoing arbitration between the parties. U.S. Foods did not timely challenge the 2008 withdrawal liability assessment, a separate assessment, and therefore Central States would ask this court to affirm the district court to remand this decision to the district court such that summary judgment can be entered in Central State's favor on its claim.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Berliner.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Kashiari?
Thank you, Your Honor. I have 2 points to make on rebuttal. The first is to key off of Judge Hamilton's comments about the merits. I would point out that the issues presented in this any withdrawal liability arbitration are complicated. They're intertwined, in this case in particular, because we have these two partial assessments that would, if we prevail before the arbitrator, be considered in the single plan year. That presents calculation issues.
Do you want to raise issues other than Egan with respect to the 2008 assessment?
Yes.
What issues do you want to raise?
Once Egan gets placed back in 2008 where it belongs, how do you calculate the single partial assessment?
Is there any other issue with respect to 2008?
Your Honor, I don't know yet, because what would happen, if I may, what would happen is, as we would argue to the arbitrator, the current assessment one is invalid. It's computed incorrectly. Therefore, the fund has to issue a new assessment. I would have to study the new assessment.
So you want to open up everything with respect to 2008?
Depending on the new assessment that we would ask
the
arbitrator.
But we don't know what those issues are.
Once I see the assessment, yes. I don't know. In the context of this case, the funds placing Egan in 2009 was the fund's own error. They corrupted the assessment one. They were the party that did that. So all of these issues really should be left in arbitration in the first instance. On the question of jurisdiction, if I may, Your Honor, or is my time
up?
The section in ERISA I was referring to says that arbitration proceedings shall be enforced in the court as if carried out under 9. That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to enforce the power of the arbitrator, and that's why we rely on Section 4 and Section 16. As to Your Honor, Judge Easterbrook, your decision that you mentioned, I just don't know that decision. I'd be happy to submit a letter explaining it and distinguishing it if the court would like.
Sure. That's fine. Okay. Well,
thank you, Your Honor.
Yeah, and thank you very much.
And just in case there's any doubt, the decision can be found at 671 Fed 3rd, 636.
Okay, we'll move on to our next case.